Afternoon, everybody. If it's Tuesday at 1 o'clock, it must be Tuesdays with Dave, although today's Thursday. So I want to welcome everybody to the call today. The first thing I want to do is give a big high five to Sharon Lovejoy from Avon, Indiana. Purchased a 12-unit property on December 22nd in Brownsburg, Indiana. Purchase price was $460,000. The value play was increasing rent, $100 to $150 per unit. Converting a laundry into digital, probably so people stop breaking in and stealing the coins, and adding a pet deposit plus a $25 a month pet fee would be also good. Cash flow is $2,800 right now, but hopes she can increase it in 90 days to $3,800. That would be pretty sweet. So, big high five to Sharon Lovejoy. Yes! All right, so, been busy at the turn of the year here. It's been very cold in Boston, less than 20 degrees for like 14 straight days. And we're having this big, huge warm-up. Right now. It's going to get up to 49 this weekend. So it'll be shorts and T-shirts. Shorts, T-shirts, and some Budweiser for the Patriots game on Sunday. Got a couple of events coming up. And that is the Los Angeles, Orange County Immersion, which is January 19th to the 21st. So if you haven't confirmed that you're going, this is the Master's Student Mentorship Student Call. If you haven't confirmed that you're going, confirm. And then the Atlanta Immersion is January 26th to the 28th as well. So you want to confirm that one too. My brother Jeff, who teaches at Immersion classes up in Hawaii teaching, when they have that ballistic missile warning, and he had like 10 minutes. They thought they were going to be alive for 10 more minutes. And so he was texting out to a bunch of people. And he sent me a text. And what he thought was the last 10 minutes of his life, he sent a text to me that simply said, "Thanks for a wonderful life." And when I got the text, it was Saturday afternoon for us. And I was like, huh. It was a confusing text. I thought, I wonder what that's all about. But, you know, if you know my brother, he's a big... if you know my brother, you know why I was wondering. So also, about 10 or 15 minutes later, on our family text, we have a family group text, he texted, "False alarm." So I texted back, "What is going on?" And then he said, "Ballistic missile warning." And then I started on the news, of course. And I thought, wow, you know, in the last 10 minutes of Jeff's life, I was one of the people that he decided to send a text to and simply said, "Thanks for a wonderful life." And I thought about it, and this wonderful life never could have happened had I not gotten into apartments all those years ago. Because we grew up very middle class, maybe a little lower middle class. My mom was a fish cutter at the Fish Fairs of Boston for 27 years. My father worked two jobs to support us. And I remember my mom doing the budget. She always budgeted with envelopes. If you got a mom that does that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But she would put her money aside in different envelopes for different things. I think I was 12 years old or 10 years old. I walked by the kitchen table one time. I said, "Mom, what are you doing?" She says, "Oh," she says, "I'm putting the money aside from where it needs to go." And I said, "Oh, so where's it go?" She says, "Oh, this envelope's for groceries, and this envelope's for the gas that heats the house, and this envelope's for the cars, and this envelope's for the mortgage, this envelope's..." And she explained them all. And I said, "Oh," I said, "you got $2 over here. That's not an envelope." She said, "Oh, that's my spending money." She had $2 to spend for the week for herself at the end of the payday. So I thought to myself, "Oh my gosh, what for?" But even though, you know, I never really knew it, I really never really understood until that particular point. I mean, we never went without, that's for sure. We never went out to eat, though. That's for sure too. We drive not to McDonald's. Nowhere. And I'd drive by restaurants and I'd be like, "Dad, let's go to McDonald's." He'd be like, "You got hamburgers at home." I'd be like, "Dad, let's get some ice cream." And we could pass the ice cream farm. Like, "You got ice cream at home." So, one time when I was 7 years old, my cousin had joined. We had gone to this recital for my cousin. She was in this dance group. And she was 7'2". Me and two other cousins were born in the same year. So she's 7'2", and at the end of it, you know, when we were all saying our goodbyes and congratulations, they were like, they're going to a Chinese restaurant. And I was like, you're going to the Chinese restaurant? She says, oh, yeah. She says, at the end of all these recitals every year, we all go to the Chinese restaurant. I was like, oh, my, oh. So I immediately started hatching a plan. I got my brother Jeff, my sister Tammy, to join dancing. And we did, and we went through the year learning how to dance, and we did this thing of three blind mice on the stage. It was pretty, I mean, six, seven, and four were the ages. Eight, six, and four were the ages of us. And also, we could go to a Chinese restaurant for the first time in our lives. So nothing really changed until we started investing in apartments. You know, we all struggled in our early adult teenage lives. We had this mindset. We had this scarcity mindset that, you know, life, the good things for other people. You know, you had to work hard, and you accepted what you were earning from the man, and you tried to save. But unfortunately, you know, it's just really hard to save back then, especially as a teenager, early 20s, high credit card bills and all that. And I was in that rock band, as most of you know, from the time I was about 16, 17 to 24. And I just get tired of it all. I get tired of living like that. I saw other people with things, and I thought, why not me? You know, why not me? And I decided that I was going to find out how it could be me. And I went through a number of different things. I went through, had my landscaping company, had my construction company, I went to all the different franchise business events, you know, me and my younger brother, we thought we would open up a franchise. You know, I had already started two other businesses. And it wasn't until I learned how to invest in real estate and I started learning, reading these books, motivational books, like Fortune Beneath Your Feet, Awaken the Giant Within, Raise the Bar. All of these things have changed my mindset. My mindset needed to be changed first. And then I could go out there and I could capitalize on that. And for me, it was the real estate. It just made sense. I mean, I thought, oh my gosh, if I could go out there and I could buy a multifamily property, somebody else would put the money up for the property, and then the people living in it would pay for the taxes, the insurance, the mortgage, the maintenance, the management, and then they would pay me at the end of every month for buying the property. I thought, oh my gosh. You know, when somebody explained that to me, I thought, if that's true, I want in. You know, and they're paying down the mortgage every month, so eventually it was free and clear. And it took me a while. It took me about 9 months to do my first deal. I learned as much as I could. I probably had enough information after a couple of months to do my first deal, but I was just too afraid to do it. And then I pulled the trigger on that deal. And I bought my first three-family, 25 Newton Street, Brockton, Mass. Within the next 3 months, I had three more. Within 6 months, I had nine. Within that first year, I had 11 properties, and life changed. Cash flow was coming in. I happened to hit it lucky. I was at the beginning to mid of a buyer's market, too, of the area. I didn't know it back then, but that's how I happened to hit it, and I had really strong leadership. With the mayor being a guy by the name of Jack Units. If you've read my book, Emerging Real Estate Markets, you'll remember that I talk about Jack Units and how his leadership actually transformed that city. So it was his leadership and being in the right place at the right time, buying properties and actually taking action is what got me my first real big start. Within 3 years, we had, I don't know, 30 or 40 of those properties. And then the market started to change. But in those 2 or 3 years, I'd become a multimillionaire. A lot of it in equity, but I had a huge amount of cash flow coming in. And I was living in a one-bedroom apartment all throughout those 3 years. I didn't go run right out and try to buy a big house. I was too busy buying apartment buildings. I mean, this thing was working. My life was changing. I had money. I just wanted to keep doing it. I remember I was working. I was working almost every day because for the first time in my life, I was making money. So all I want to do is keep doing this. So, you know, weekends didn't bother me. Nights didn't bother me. Things were moving. And I remember one Thanksgiving, probably into the second year, a broker had called me the day before and said, hey, we've got this foreclosed property. It's over on Warren Ave near Spring Street in Brockton. And I can get you in there tomorrow morning, which was Thanksgiving. And I thought, well, you know, the family activities don't usually start until about noon. I usually go to the football game, but we used to drink heavily before the football game, the 10 o'clock football game. We all meet at the local bar before, while I was in the rock band. And I had stopped doing that when I started my business. So I thought I could skip that, and I'll skip the football game, and I'll go over and I'll meet the family at the regular time. So the house is all boarded up. I'm with this this broker's name, Brian Allen. So he showed me through this property. He was also a property owner too. So he showed me through this property, and he's like, "What do you think? Do you think this is a deal?" And we got flashlights for the first floor because it's all boarded up. The second floor had a little bit of light. Well, we're up on the second floor. All of a sudden, we heard. Now we had to unscrew this the plywood that was on the door. Okay, so we unscrew the plywood, we open it up, and as we're on the second floor, all of a sudden, we hear voices on the first floor. I'm like, oh, crap. People came in. And it sounded like big guy voices. And this is the neighborhood that I just explained is the worst neighborhood in the city. So I'm thinking, oh, damn. There's a bunch of people downstairs now, and there's no other way out. This house is completely boarded up unless you want to jump out the second floor window, which was definitely an option. And then we started smelling crack. So they're smoking crack in the kitchen, right by the doorway of the only way out. So I'm thinking, oh, damn, what are we going to do? And Ryan says, he says, don't worry. He says, follow me, right? And he pulls out a gun. And I think, oh, my God. I was kind of worried, but I wasn't as worried until he pulled out that gun. And I thought, oh, my God, I am going to be shot dead Thanksgiving morning, you know, in this abandoned property in the worst section of Brockton. They're not going to find my body, you know, for days, months, maybe even years, maybe even never, all because I wanted a better life for myself. This is what I'm thinking as I'm crouching down behind the broker as he's got the gun pointed out as we're walking down the stairs to go to the kitchen. And as you hear these people talking, all of a sudden, you know, there's girls in the mixture too, and one girl starts shouting something and laughing really loud, and all of a sudden the broker stands straight up, right? And I stood straight up so I could make sure I was still behind him. And he says, Mary Ellen Sweeney, Mary Ellen Sweeney, is that you? And she's like, what the F? She says, who is that? She says, Mary Ellen, it's Brian Allen, I'm in the house with a client. And we're coming through the kitchen and we're going to get out of here. She goes, Brian Allen, you get your white ass out here. Apparently Mary Ellen was one of Brian's tenants, thank God, and he knew her. And we walked into the kitchen, and they're like, what are you people doing upstairs in the house? And he's like, we're just trying to sell the house. You know, we're going to go home and enjoy Thanksgiving. Hope you guys have a great Thanksgiving. It's like, oh, my God, thanks God. Thank God. So that's one of the many, many stories you have from being in this business, and that was a story from early on in the business. But it wasn't until I started investing in apartments, and after that, I actually asked Jeff to invest with me. It's another long story about how I was broke when we first started. I thought you needed money. And I'd gone to several people to try to get the money to do my first deal. And Jeff was one of them. He was an engineer, an electrical engineer. Got a good job coming out of college. And I remember sitting in my apartment telling him about the opportunities in Brockton. And he basically said, He said, I don't want to invest in Brockton. He says, Brockton's full of pimps, pushers, and drug dealers. He says, plus, you know, me and Joe, we won't get tampered. I'm like, okay. So the end of that story is that I invested with my best friend, Rob, and credit cards to invest because we couldn't find anybody with money that would invest with us. So anyways, it was about a year and a half, 2 years later, and he saw that I was wearing better clothes, had a better used car. I was able to buy beers at the bar, you know, on a Friday night, which I very rarely did before. And realized things were changing and wanted to know why. And I told him it was the apartments. So he got involved in apartments. And then Tammy got involved in apartments, and they all got involved in, eventually, this education business started about 8 to 10 years afterwards. After that, we all started investing in apartments. And everybody, we're one big happy family when we come in the morning. Not just my brother and my sister and my mom who's here, but also all the other people that work here too. One big happy family. And all because of multi-family investing. So there you have it. It's a wonderful life. So I'm going to start taking questions. The way you get in there is star zero. We'll get you into the queue. The operator will introduce you into the call, and I will I'll answer any and all of your questions. I am going to answer an email question while you guys are queuing up. This one comes from John Dove from Kansas City, Missouri. He says, I know First Get Private Money will need to have property packages and a business plan, and I'm not good at putting these together. Any suggestions or resources to help facilitate this process? Is there a service or a company that put these things together, like professional resume? So, John, I'm assuming that you're in the Mastery or Mentorship Program, because that's what this call is. So inside of this program is the private money boot camp. So you go to that private money boot camp, and that gives you the templates for your property package. And also, there's inside of the online learning center, there is a there is a business plan that I created when I was when I owned like about 150, 200 units. It was right before the leap I made to get to over 8,000 units. So that business plan is actually inside that learning center as well. And you may, if you can't find it, email over to Jeff Genie or Jermaine. Jeff is actually still in Hawaii, enjoying himself. But email to them, and they will be happy to send it out to you. And that will be the template that you can use. Also, if you go into the Business Building Blueprint inside of your mentorship website, the Business Building Blueprint is an online learning as well for business building, and I do the two-day business building here that complements that. There is a section, I forget which module it is, but it's all about creating a business plan, and there's also some templates in there as well. So there you go. So, operator, who is my first caller today?
Okay, first question comes from Heather. Heather, please go ahead. Hey, Dave, how are you?
Hey, Heather, what's going on?
Not too much. Thank you for the amazing storytelling.
Yeah.
You had me laughing out loud with the dance class for a year for Chinese food.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
It was worth it.
I hear you. I related a lot to your family story. We come from a really poor family myself originally, and now, you know, we're a family of teachers, so we're hoping for a success story, and, you know, along the lines of yours, and doing this with my sister, which makes it a lot of fun, and we're enjoying the process. So thank you for everything.
You're welcome.
My question today is about LOIs. I believe at the immersion training, Jeff said that in order to submit an LOI, you have to have rentals and like a T3. But are there any other, are there ever circumstances where you would submit an LOI without, you know, those pieces of information? For example,
you may not be able to access it, so without it, and you still want to do the deal based on the pro formas, you would do it in that situation. Excuse me. So that would be really the only situation you would want to do it. You want to get that information. So
okay.
You know, a real offer.
Like a good, right. Because in this scenario, we have a rent roll, but we have a bunch of the information that would be that you find on the T3, but it's compiled by the seller. It's not an official T3. But it's a pocket listing, and we found out that there's another buyer that caught wind of it through a partner of the broker. So we just didn't know if we should try to get in there with the information that we have quickly or just hold off and be patient and wait.
You can certainly do that. There's nothing wrong with it. You'll have a 30-day due diligence, so you can certainly back out a deal that doesn't look like the deal that you thought it was going in.
Oh, okay. Okay, and so we're looking at a 16-unit property, so it's actually an offer to purchase instead of an LOI. Is that right? Just confirming that. So I use the right lingo.
Yeah.
Okay.
16-unit, yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, thanks, Dave. Appreciate that.
Welcome. Good luck out there.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thank you. Okay, who's next?
Okay, up next we have Gene. Gene, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. Gene from Washington, D.C. Thank you for that story. I'm also reading your book. I'm in the middle of the emerging real estate market book. Yeah. I'm in a similar boat. As you were with the street family. And I guess my question is, how did you structure it? How did you structure that deal? I say that because I'm investing in Baltimore. Yeah, your first deal. I say that because I'm investing in Baltimore. I'm obviously looking at Baltimore Philly area for multi-units. However, I'll give you an example. Marcus Millichap sent me a 12-unit deal. They are basically two family row homes that are right next to each other, six in one row and then back to back. I'm having a hard time adding value to asking $60,000 per door. However, I'm buying, I've already bought over 10 row homes separate in a community, and I'm buying them for, let's say, about $100,000, so slightly more, but my rent's also higher, like $1,350. The Marcus Miller chat, that there were 70 per door, but the rents were only $840. So I know I feel I can add more value with these single row homes I'm buying. But the challenge I'm having is how can I structure it with, I have investors that want to invest. So how would I structure that to make it work? Because when I'm doing it, it doesn't seem to cash flow as well.
So how are you trying to structure that deal again? What's your
interest? So like when I compare row homes with multifamily, at least in the Baltimore area, the buying row homes separately, I can add more value and they rent more. So I'm trying to use investors to buy row homes, and just buy a bunch of them, like say 30 of them in one area. And, I guess if I, right.
Are they contiguous?
No, they're not contiguous. They're like in a, let's say a zip code or within a few blocks of each other.
They're all single families. They're all one-off deals. You got to treat them like
single families. So, and even that, if I look at the one-off deal, I was just curious how you structured that. Your first deal, was it 50-50 split? For example, I had one investor who...
If it's one investor, you typically do a 50-50 split, but you can negotiate a 60-40, whatever you can negotiate. You know, it's all negotiable. The first one I did with credit cards. My first two were credit cards, and then I went hard money after that. There was a program when I first started, as long as the deal came in at 65 cents on the dollar, and that included the sales price and the construction cost, then they would fund it 100%, which was great.
Okay.
There wasn't a lot of deals I qualified for that, but when I found them, it was great because I could get it with no money down, and I get all the construction costs, too, taken care of.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, who's next?
Okay, next we have Phil. Phil, please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. This is Phil from Chicago.
Hey, Phil. What's going on in Chicago?
It's cold.
Yeah, it's cold everywhere.
Things are happening here for us. We have read your books and have gone through your classes. Me, personally, I really appreciate your mentorship. Website.
Okay.
I've gone through the core competencies, and I found myself taking my own notes as I go through each one. A few months passed by, I figured, okay, I want to refresh myself on, like, the acquisition process. I went back and noticed that there were some things that were added or taken out from the website. I'm glad it's being updated and managed. Is there a way that you or your staff can let us know when there's something new that gets added or changed? So we can keep track of it.
Good point. We can also bring that up at the next meeting. Have to talk to the tech guys and figure out how that can be done.
Right, because, if you're adding a change, you're approving it, and I appreciate it. I use it. But that would be a great way to go right to the things that you think are important that got added or changed or modified.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start to right away. I'll talk to the tech team, see how they can do that. That's a good one.
Great, appreciate it. But otherwise, the website, nice job.
It's loaded.
It is. It's pretty cool. Thanks.
Yeah. Use it and prosper.
Thanks.
All right. Who's next? By the way, this line has like a quarter of a second delay on it. So so you may, if you're talking, you may hear it. And if you're listening, you may hear it as well. But that's why sometimes there's an overlap. I'm ready for the next caller. Who's next?
Okay, next we have Stu. Stu, please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. How are you? I'm on the phone with my wife and I, Barbara, and I signed on early November, and we've been having a wonderful time so far. So we're very happy that we're involved in your educational process. A question I have for you was that I've noticed a few times in the financial statements of properties, they refer to reserves. The one I'm looking at now says reserves at $300 per unit, and they noted it right under the NOI. Where do we account for that in the Excel spreadsheet?
In the Excel, the reserves, I believe, they're either right above, they're either the very last item on the operating expenses, or they're right below total operating expenses. But I believe we changed it and put it in as the last item in the, under the operating expenses. Because that's because you really you need to include it into your ratios, so that's why we made that change. So you know you're gonna need that fund those funds eventually. You gotta account for them.
Yes, I absolutely agree. Just was trying to figure out where I would put it. Is there a new? Has the form changed since we received this? I don't.
Do you have the form in front of you?
I do.
Do you? Is it the last item listed on the operating expenses?
No. Total expenses are above the total expense line, says payroll.
What about below that total expense line? Well, you
know, NOI?
It's over on the, it's below there. Yeah, so NOI, then what below that?
CapEx, cash flow reactive capital, primary debt service, secondary debt service.
Whoa. It's CapEx.
Oh, that would go into CapEx.
Yep, that's capital expenditures. Reserves.
Okay. That's what I need. Okay. So the reserves are the CapEx.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. I didn't understand that. Sorry.
No problem. You know, so now you want to either, the best thing to do is I thought we changed that form so it actually appeared in the operating expenses so nobody forgot to add it into the cash-on-cash return and debt coverage ratios. So you want to make, everybody wants to make a mental note of that, is the CapEx should actually be into the operating expenses, even though it's not a true operating expense, because most of that CapEx is, depreciated over 27 and a half years. But you're going to need that money, and your ratios are based on money that you need, you know, and how that property is performing. And these ratios are what you're telling your investors, you can get them as a return. So since you're going to be spending that money and you're going to need it, it needs to be included in those ratios.
Okay, swell. Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Good luck.
Thank you.
All right, so check this out. My mom's going to be baptized for the first time in her life. We were brought up Baptist, so my brothers and sisters and I got baptized when we were 14. So she started going back to the church. You know, as you get older, you start getting concerned when you start seeing the end coming. And you want to, you know, you want to get all the insurance you can get. So she started going back to church, and she used to be baptized this weekend. And then she got a call from the reverend saying that they were postponing the baptism and they were reviewing her case. What does that say? You know, are they not going to baptize her for some reason? Why would that be? So we all get a really good laugh out of that on our family group text that they postponed the baptism for further review. It's crazy. All right, who's next?
Oh, my God.
I know. Who's next? Hopefully nothing happens to my mom between now and then. She's got to get that soul saved. Who's next on the line?
Okay, up next we have Ryan. Ryan, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. It's Ryan from India. How are you doing?
Hey Ryan, what's going on over there? Are you the one that did the had the question for the deal? Let me see. Oh, no.
I was the Tampa one from a couple weeks ago.
Okay, nice. So what's going on in your world?
Well, I had a question more on the fund.
You did the deal a couple weeks ago in Tampa. Is that what you just said?
Well, I had a question about it.
Okay.
Kind of had struggles with getting in contact with the broker since then, actually, but still working on that. I have a kind of situation with a money sourcing, and I figured you'd be the best guy for that. So my girlfriend works for a guy. He's a startup. He does educational stuff for schools in different places. He is coming into contact with the Walton family within the next couple of days. What kind of advice would you give for me to make myself of a value to the guy meeting that family so that it would possibly be aligned that I get to meet them at some point in time through him?
You got to figure out what their needs are. And then you got to see if there's alignment with you satisfying what their investment needs are. So that's the first step. And then the second step is showing, showing what you do, what your business model is.
Okay. I want to make myself an asset to the person that will be meeting them so I can make that connection, but I'm still trying to figure out what exactly that could possibly be.
But you know meeting one of the Waltons or some high net worth individual, and you want them to see, you want to see if you can become of value to the person that's the mediary.
Correct. So that I could kind of create that bridge.
What does that person do?
He's my girlfriend's boss. I don't really know the guy too well, but they do school type stuff. They create computer involved databases and platforms for schools.
All right. So what's his intent when he meets with this person?
He wants to talk to them about financing for expanding it across the region and in the country at some point.
Oh, so, and then after he does his pitch, you're hoping that he's going to do a pitch for you?
Well, I'm hoping that, I would just be glad if I got to meet them or my name was dropped on their desk or something.
How would a meeting go about? Would this gentleman need to say, oh, by the way, I know this guy invests in multifamily properties. If you're interested in multifamily investments?
I was thinking that would be the easiest thing for him to be able to do. He doesn't even know I'm going to be trying to make this bridge, but that would probably be, in my opinion, the easiest transition from, his topic to encompass mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the way. You're going to have to sell yourself as to what's the benefit to him for doing that for you. You got to figure that out. Some sort of a benefit. Maybe you split the acquisition fee with him on the first deal or something, but there's got to be a benefit for him to do that.
Right. I just didn't know if there was a good way to go about doing that because I'm still trying to figure it out.
Is there a good way to approach the middle guy, the middleman?
Right.
I would do that. I would just say, hey, I know you're going to be meeting with these people. I know you're going to pitch them on this, and I invest in multifamily properties, and, the typical deal brings this type of return or this type of an acquisition fee, and if you'd be willing just to hand them my card, if they call me and we do a deal together, I'll be happy to give you half of that acquisition fee.
Okay, that sounds good. One other thing I wanted to do real quick for all the people on the line, I am in Indiana. I know that's a high-value target. I'm offering boots on the ground to all students if they ever need anything. Would you like me to give my number?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. Again, my name is Ryan Dufalo. I'm in Indianapolis area. My number is 317-292-6888.
All right.
All right. Great. I appreciate it.
How you make out?
Pardon?
That's not how you make out.
I'm sorry, you're coming broken.
Let us know how you do.
Okay, will do. I appreciate it, dude.
Yep. Okay, it's 1:34 on the Wise Cracker Line. I haven't seen Saturday Night Live lately. I haven't seen any good spoofs on Trump. I do have a DVR in my recording, so I'm going to have to check that out. Let's see, I'm going to take a question from Tom Loesch from Philadelphia. Tom writes in and says, I'm reaching out to brokers in my area and there's a property that I'm interested in. The broker says that I could only get financial statements as recent as 2:15. 2:15? What are they, high? Do you suggest I go visit this property first or should I do the analysis first? What's there to analyze? That's 2 years ago. Should you visit the property? I don't know. I would try to get some sort of commitment to get updated financials. Otherwise, this is what happens when you don't have updated financials. If they don't do it off some sort of a software, then they have to recreate them. I mean, do you really want people recreating their software? I mean, recreating their data. And what I have found, early on, I chased everything. I used to chase deals like this. I have found that when they actually complete the analysis, they can't even justify what they're asking for a price because they didn't realize that their expenses were so high and they were making such little money. Number one, and number two, I have never had a deal like this come together. So I spent a lot of energy on these types of deals at the beginning, And then after the third one didn't come together, I started seeing a pattern, you know, that these deals don't go together. So I stopped chasing them. But if you get nothing better to do, then chase it. But I think your time would be better spent on more marketing, better relationships with your brokers, and getting good quality deals coming in. One more from Shane Williams from Mooresville, in Indiana. Another Indiana. You know, I was up in Indiana. I own in Anderson, Indiana. So I'm up there a couple weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and I discovered this candy store for the first time. Oh, what the heck was the name? I think it was called Sweets. Sweets Candy. And so, of course, you know, it was a sign on the highway. So I plugged it into my GPS, and I headed right over there, and they had the best mixed white dark chocolate popcorn. And I'd forgotten all about that. A big container to bring home. Ate it all. And now I've got to find them again and get some mail order. Mail order of that popcorn. It was really, really good. So anyways, Shane Williams from Mooresville writes in, are there commercial rules of thumb or commercial underwriting template for the purchase of a strip mall? There are rules of thumb, but there isn't an underwriting template because you really need some sort of a software for this. Argus puts out a software. It's expensive. It's $5,000 to buy it. You have to immediately pay $800 for training because they don't give you the training. And then you have to pay for customer service in case you have any questions on the training. So typically your all-in cost at the beginning is about $7,000. Bob Bowman, who full disclosure is a partner of mine, he also teaches commercial property boot camp, has a commercial software of which I have no affiliation with. Bob created this thing by himself and his partner, and it's a beautiful piece of software. It goes for a lot less. It goes for about $2,000. And the reason that you need a software is that there are two factors that we look at in commercial deals that we don't look at in apartments. And that is typically the lease term is a lot longer. It's anywhere from 3 to 5 years and sometimes 10 to 100 years. And then when you get a new tenant in, you have what's called tenant improvements. So if you have a brand new tenant going into a unit, those tenant improvements are going to be anywhere from $10 to $15 per square foot. If you've got a tenant that's releasing at the end of their lease, those tenant improvements are $3 to $5 per square foot. So that expense needs to be added in to the year that you have a tenant releasing. So it's not like apartments where you're turning every year. Your leases are turning, and you have turn expenses, but usually it's as a percentage of the revenues that come in. But with the commercial properties, they're a big chunk the years they come in. So you need to know when they're coming in because it's going to affect your cash flow. So that's one thing. But the real dilemma with this is you don't know whether or not someone's going to release or not when their lease term expires, say 3, 4, 5 years out, maybe even year two. So you have to use a probability of release. And the probability of release, the number you should be using if you're conservative, is 65%. So you're going to assume that 65% of all the tenants that that their lease expires is going to release. So in doing that, there's a calculation within the probability and the amount of the tenant improvements per square footage that is allocated for that particular year of expenses. There's also the fact that if they do not release, that there's going to be a vacancy period as well. So if there's a release, then there's no vacancy period. If there's a lease, that vacancy period could be anywhere from 3 to 12 months. Typically, the average is 6 months for a commercial property. So all these factors are taken into play when you put your variables in on this commercial software, and it gives you the probability of what your expense is going to be or what expense you should allocate for that particular year. And that's going to affect your cash-on-cash return and your debt coverage ratio. Well, your cash-on-cash return is what you're really concerned about when you're going into the deal. So that's going to affect that. So that's why you need software to do it. That's why, you could do this by hand, but it takes a long time, And what if you make one calculation wrong? So you got to get software. And if anybody's interested in Bob's software, you can call over Jeannie at the office or Jermaine here at the office. They'll be happy to get you some information on it. Yes, we do. We're an education company. We sell education, so we sell Bob's product for our education company. But it's a really good product. Just like all our other products, it's a really good product. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Who's our next caller?
Okay, up next we have Lorraine. Lorraine, please go ahead.
Hi, Dave. Lorraine from Laguna Beach. How are you?
Hey, Lorraine. What's going on? Now, it's funny. I mentioned Saturday Night Live, right? And Lorraine Newman calls in. Unbelievable. How's it going? How's life been since the show?
It's been great.
Excellent.
Okay. Lorraine Fiore. Lorraine Fiore, by the way.
Oh, Lorraine Fiore. Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Not quite as Spanish. So my daughter and I just took the boot camp early this month, and I'm going on the immersion bus this weekend in L.A. and Orange County.
You don't love that. You don't love Jeffy. Crazy.
I'm totally excited. I'm actually a real estate agent in California. I have been for a little while working with an investor for properties for him. So I'm a bit familiar. I'm not starting on ground level, so to speak. My daughter is much more detail-oriented. She's my partner, and she'll keep me in line with organization and time management. So we're a great team. I have several different brokers. I mean, I hit the ground running the Monday after boot camp, and I have three brokers I'm working with in Texas and one in New York. This one in Texas has been great. It's been College Station area, but what he has for me are their off-market properties. One is a 12-plex, one is a duplex. Excuse me. There are three fourplexes that he has in one package, so that's 12 units. And then he has a duplex and a fourplex. And because I live in Laguna Beach and because this is in Texas, it was recommended to me that I try to focus on, rather than smaller properties, larger properties because I'll be traveling. And he also has a 34-home package. So they're all homes in a package, and they're east of Dallas.
Yep.
But they're all separate homes being sold as a package. They all need work. And
are they all homes in a package?
They are all homes in a package, and they're all rentals.
Okay, gotcha.
So they want to sell it for $2.7 million for the 34 homes.
And they're
all next to each other.
They're all
in the community, so they've each got a yard and some room. It's actually kind of rural country, so they're all different homes, but they're all in a community, so to speak, I guess you would say. They're not spread out all over the town. So I was told that I'd be better to focus on larger multifamily units because they'd be easier to manage if I'm going to have to fly out there. And so I thought I would get your thought on this particular thing first.
It's certainly one of the ways you can make money is buying a package of single-family properties. And it does make it easier by them being all near each other or next to each other. So if it's something that you can wrap your arms around and do the analysis and understand it, I think the biggest difficulty you'll find is getting the financing that has some sort of a release clause in there, because you'll probably get financing under one umbrella. And you'll need some sort of a release clause in there that they release the properties as you sell them individually, unless you're going to resell them out of the package, which isn't going to be an issue. But usually you end up selling them off individually because that's how you make your most money. But the way these clauses are usually set up is that you will not see any money until the bank's paid off, which means that all your profit will lie in the last few houses that you sell.
Okay.
In the meantime, you could be getting great cash flow.
Yeah, he said the cash flow is great.
Hmm.
So he also has a so you would say that possibly that might be a good investment.
Yeah.
Okay. And then
really good management company down there, you know.
Yeah, and that's what he says they're lacking. He said the management companies down there are really lacking. Yeah.
That's the key. I'd be very nervous about this.
Okay.
Deal.
All right. Thank you for that. And then he also has a military housing, which has 30 units. He's right now they're getting about 11.5% cap rate.
Yeah.
But the long term in this property is that the properties don't really go up in value. They stay the same. So that even though the cash flow is really great, as far as having it, you know, to sell off in 3 to 5 years for an investor, not so great because the value is not going to go up so much. So your thought on that?
First of all, I'm very concerned about military housing because people get deferments. And anytime I have a property that's around the base area, we don't try to keep it less than 10% military for that reason, because of the risk. So I'd be nervous about the sale because of that. Also, you know, they could have a realignment, and they could, you know, wipe out the entire base, which would, you'd have to, you know, put new people in your problem. How many units is it?
30. It's 100% occupied right now.
So, and your fear is that you won't see appreciation?
Correct.
Because right now the rents are higher than market?
Because it won't sell, because the values just don't change in that area, he said. The values just don't go up. They pretty much stay the same. So even though you're getting great cash flow, the selling it in 3 to 5 years, not going to be a lot of change in the selling price.
Can you increase the cash flow? Any value adds?
Yes.
I'm not sure who the broker is, but anytime you increase the cash flow of the property, the value is going to increase, even if the cap rates remain the same. You know, so his saying that values just don't increase here, that tells me that you've got a stagnant market, which is okay, but it's not great because, you know, a lot of job growth coming in, you don't have competition for the rents, and rents don't increase. But if you can take a property based on the current capitalization rates, which what he's saying will remain stagnant, and increase that cash flow, just multiplied by the current capitalization rate, that value will increase.
Okay. And then my next question is, there's one in an oil hub in Midland, Odessa.
Yeah.
And it's a corporate housing, corporate lodging.
Yeah. How many units?
60 units.
All right.
And they're asking $4,070,000 in rents they make off of it a month.
Yeah.
And another, probably a similar situation where really good cash flow. I don't have the cap rate on this piece of paper in front of me for some reason. But your thought on that?
What's
corporate housing, I guess. Your thought on corporate housing, corporate lodging.
Is it all corporate, all 60 units?
Yeah.
That's very unusual if it is.
But it's all
different. Units is corporate?
Yes,
my definition of
different.
Corporate housing is it's like a hotel room. They come in for 3 or 4 months, but everything's there, everything that they need, and they get maid service. Is that what you're thinking?
They don't have maid service. What they do is that different corporations lease out, say, 5 rooms, 7 rooms, 10 rooms, and they do have kitchenettes in them, but the different corporations rent out. Would be renting different.
You know what? I'm not that familiar with that type of. I've never actually heard an entire complex being run like that. I'm sure they're getting much better cash flow than normal. My fear would be, the oil industry crashed, and if this property
exactly
does well, then that's good. Then you've got a solid property. But you know, I would be concerned that if it switches over from corporate to a regular apartment, those rents are going to come back down to the market. So I would see how far over market you are.
Okay, because he literally said if the oil market crashes, these apartments are history.
It already crashed.
Well, it keeps going up and down.
Well, yeah, but it hasn't really gone above 50.
Right, right.
You know? So if it's running now, though, after the crash, then it could be good. All right, listen, I've got to move on because I got to take some more calls. I've got like 11 minutes left.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome. Bye, Lorraine Newman.
Bye.
All right, where's my Rosanna Dana? Where's my cheeseburger? All right, who's next on the line?
Okay, up next we have Dan. Dan, please go ahead.
No Coke Pepsi.
All right, well, no Rosanna, but you just got a Dana.
nice one, Dan.
Yeah, Dan Byers, Newport Beach. I'm also doing the immersion course this weekend out here.
Ask Jeff about what happened out in Hawaii. to tell you about it.
Yeah, that sounds real interesting. That'd be pretty surreal.
He was teaching.
What's that?
He was teaching. He was teaching the event.
Yeah. Crazy.
What's crazy?
So question on financing and swaps versus ARMs. 10-year swap, 4.93, an ARM at 5%. I'm just refinancing some assets that I already own and plan on holding the assets, for a while. What's your thoughts as far as doing a swap?
Just like swapping property for property?
No. A loan product. Swap. The loan product. Where it's, basically where the lender basically guarantees that they're going to get their return for the next 10 years. And if rates go up, then if interest rates go up, then there's, I can get out of it. But if, interest rates stay the same or drop and you elect to sell, then you've got to come up with that balance. Your prepayment penalty is the balance of that interest.
What's the benefit to you?
Not much, other than, saving just a couple fractions of a point, on rate.
Sounds like more risk than reward.
Well, that's kind of what that's where I'm at, but I'm going, I've heard other people doing, the swaps on stuff, and it was brought up as one of the examples during the boot camp. One of the scenarios was that there was a buyout, for a prepayment, and, that had to be kind of recalculated back into the transaction.
Yeah, that is, defeasance. Yeah, the prepayment penalty, or another word for it is the defeasance or yield maintenance. There's a website called Defease with Ease. So yeah, so you're locked in for a certain period of time, and if you sell before that, yeah, because these things are, okay, now I understand what you're asking me. These things are in what may be called a derivative swap or a mortgage-backed security. So therefore, since they're packaged with other loans going out, they need to secure, they sold this product, and this loan was part of this overall product. So they need to get a minimum return for that. So therefore, the deal is priced based on, if you sell early, well, they got to figure out, what you're going to owe them for selling early. So that's done on a regular basis, by the way. That's just how, unless you go to a local bank, you may be able to get away from it. The defeasance part of it, or yield maintenance, is just like a straight
right.
But usually that's why you have the assumptions. So you can assume it to the next guy. And that's why it's great right now to lock in the rate for 7 to 10 years, because rates will go up. And then it will be more attractive when you assume it out, and assuming it out allows you to defer the prepayment penalty to the next person.
Yeah, it was interesting. I asked about the assumption side of it, and they came back to me and told me that it was not going to be an assumable product.
Really?
Which made it less attractive. Basically the only, positive for me is if rates, do go up, that, they're saying potentially, I would actually get paid, that spread of, whatever that, a portion of it. And I have not asked for the numbers to see what percentage that would be, that, if the rate went up from 4.93 to 5.93, what portion of that would I get if I did decide to sell during that 10-year period. So,
they can break that up to you. They should usually break out. Well, they should. You should know what you're getting into.
Right. Okay. On face value, given a 5-1 ARM at 5% versus a 10-year fixed at 4.93,
I wouldn't do the
ARM. What would you kind of say?
I wouldn't do an ARM. I'd do a fixed, and I'd do the 10.
Wait, you say that again?
I do the 10.
Oh, you would do the 10 with the swap?
Oh, I didn't know you were talking about the swap, but I would do that swap. I wouldn't do the swap, and I wouldn't do it on either. The rates are going to go up. I do a 5,
right.
Do a 7, or a 10-year balloon.
Yep, okay. Yeah, that's what I'm doing right now is looking to see what my cost on a 7-1 arm would be. So, okay. All right.
All right, good luck.
Okay. All right.
All right, I got time for 2 more callers. So who's going to be? Who's up first?
Okay. Up next is Roy. Roy, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. This is Roy out of Dallas. How are you, brother?
Roy, what's going on?
Well, we thought we were going to get the snow, but it looks like you guys got it all, so we're disappointed.
we'll get down to you eventually, I'm sure, at least once this winter.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm not for the Patriots this weekend, so.
You're not?
But, no. Not my Cowboys fan, so.
I'm sorry. I can't hear you.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. Yep.
Oh, I think we're being disconnected, Roy. Sorry.
That's what most of the folks in your office tell me all the time. Hey,
listen, here's the deal. Nobody cares here in New England that people hate us, hate our New England Patriots.
Uh-huh.
We just don't care.
Uh-huh.
So you can hate us. It's okay.
That's right. Absolutely.
We'll still win.
Yeah.
All right, what's going on?
I'm a proponent of the software with Bob. It has helped me out tremendously. But I got a question I just want to hear on a top level regarding student housing. It's here in our backyard. And the cap rate here on this deal that we're working at is about 8.5, and it's 56 units. And they're asking for 2.3. But my overall question is, what is your take on student housing, given that most of them will expire, before the summer, and then we make ready for August time frame? But just an overview of what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, you just have to – you want to get into a market where it's a yearly expiration and not a 9-month expiration where some of it turn to. And then student housing, I like student housing. You just have to be prepared to, do those releases and get them all done in that time frame. It's a hustle, hustle, hustle for like 60 days, but then after that, you're set for the year. So student housing.
Which is what the broker told me. Mm-hmm. Which is what the broker told me. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. In a market that downturns, student housing is going to maintain its value better than most. So
I like to do it. Okay, all right, okay, we'll pursue it. Absolutely, okay, yeah, thank you. Go Cowboys. Are the Cowboys still in it? Are the Cowboys still in the playoffs? <laughs> Oh my goodness. <laughs> You guys, we don't really look on the other side until the Super Bowl. Then we figure out who we're gonna play. Oh man, oh boy. <laughs> You're so <laughs> funny. You've earned it, you've earned it. <laughs> Take care. All right, have a good day. All right, who's my last caller today?
Okay, our last question comes from Tom. Tom, please go ahead.
Tom?
Yes, Dave. Hi, Tom. I was just in the Philly boot camp over the weekend, and I was able to come to your request to get those donuts. It's a shame you weren't able to be there to eat them. I was able to get to the place before they closed because I knew you knew they weren't open on Sunday, but I didn't even watch the Eagles game, so I made sure because they closed at 7 by the time we got out of Philly downtown with traffic. It was around 5, and I made it by 5 minutes. So I hope the gang enjoyed them. And I've got to tell you, your two little ones are adorable.
Yeah, they're crazy, huh? They're crazy. Thanks.
So, yeah, actually, it was a question that you had read, but I didn't hear the question or your answer. It was about I'm making about 3 property visits this weekend and, just get my feet wet. And one of them is a fully occupied property, about 18 units. And what is the best way for me to get a lot of information out of her without pressing her? And because we build up a really good rapport, and I know that she's trying to feed a few other possibility of properties my way, so I want to make sure I stay on her good side.
Is she giving you financials? You actually stay on her good side by asking the good questions, you know, and the questions that an investor would ask, and that is the, what the financials are and what the condition of the property.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, she kind of, okay, I'll do that. Thank you. Yeah. I'm trying to get to see as many units as possible. She was a little hesitant on showing me any more than one or two out of 18. And I thought that the good due diligence is to visit as many as possible, even if it's in the beginning stage.
Yeah, you know, the thing to do is, she doesn't want to be dragged around. The thing to do is to see if you can get the financials for all 18, analyze them, and the ones that look like they're worth the best, then you request to go there. But yeah, you spend this time, you know, the first three, look at the property with the broker, asking the right questions, which you got at the boot camp, you know, just using the right language, which you learned at the boot camp as well, and just, you know, coming across as confident. And then, of course, build rapport. The whole purpose for meeting is to build rapport, build rapport. Yeah, figure out what you have in common with each other, and just focus on it.
I think she owns the property herself. She's a broker. And I think all the tenants are of like culture. It's an Asian area. And I just want to make sure, like I said, that we build that rapport. I don't want to do anything to put my foot in my mouth.
Hmm. Yep, that's what I tell you to do. Just be yourself and find that commonality and then ask the right questions.
Appreciate it. Hey, last thing, if you had to take an educated guess on where Amazon's going to come out in the East Coast?
I don't know. I don't think it's going to be Boston, I can tell you that. Boston's too convenient. I think was Atlanta in the running? Who were the ones that are in the running? I can tell you which one I thought when I was looking at this a while ago.
Baltimore, I think I heard.
Baltimore was in the running?
Because it's near the water.
Yeah.
Near the water. Yeah.
That's a tough one. Okay. It would be good. I mean, those Giants
right,
in Baltimore. I don't have.
That'll be the crystal ball.
Yep.
It'll be. All right.
You know, Huntsville's getting 4,000 jobs from Toyota.
Ooh. All right. Made a mental note of that.
Yeah. All right. Be good. Good luck. All right, everyone. Your homework is to get out there, get in two offers this week, get into two networking situations, and build your investor list, and just do a little bit every day. A little bit every day is going to get you there. Don't put it off and chunk it. Chunking it won't do it. Treat it like a business and do your homework and prosper. All right, so I'll see everybody in 2 weeks on the next Tuesdays with Dave. All right, everybody.